All right, welcome back to Tangential Banter. My name is Ben Mel, and I'm here again with Jack Korzenowski.
Ahoy there.
Ahoy, indeed. We're getting rolling on season three again. Got some fresh new topics ready to go, lined up. So, let's dive into it.
Let's do it. And we're going to start with Mr. Ben, a little anecdote that you have for us that happened to you sometime this past week, I think.
My wife Sarah has been taking this class for medical interpretation. So it's English to Spanish. And one of the exercises that she has to do is read a medical article that's written in Spanish, and then she has to read it out loud in English as she goes through, or vice versa. So it could be written in English, and she has to interpret it to Spanish out loud as she goes through. And so that's kind of the setting of this. And the other night she had been taking her class and we sat down to have dinner, and we have these slightly curved drinking glasses, and I was just basically sliding the glass around the table as if it was a sailboat, because it kind of looked like the curve of a sail full of wind. And so I made a comment about how it looked like a sailboat, and then Sarah said that she thought it looked like the dorsal fin of a shark. And for whatever reason, I can't explain, the word dorsal got stuck in my head. And I knew that there is a term, like a biological term, for that means the opposite of dorsal, because dorsal is like, referring to the back or the like spinal part of an animal. And I was trying to think of what is the word that's the opposite of dorsal. But I was just really hung up and stuck. I couldn't think of what it was. And so I was kind of like sitting there kicking out these other words for that meant the same thing. And I was like, oh, is it distal was the word that came to mind. It kind of sounded similar. So I looked up distal, and I didn't think it was right, but distal means the end of an appendage that's opposite of where it's attached. So like your fingers would be at the distal end of your arm because your arm is attached to the shoulder.
Say that again, what distal means?
Distal means the opposite end of something from where it is attached.
Oh, okay. Okay, so your arm is attached to your body at your shoulder,
Yes.
and that your fingers are on the distal end of that, meaning they're on basically the end of your arm.
Well, yeah, like the unattached end of my arm,
Yeah,
right?
okay.
Which led, well, as a sidebar, so the opposite of that is proximal. So proximal would be the end where it is attached, which kind of makes sense, like the close end. But so I was just like thinking through and just stuck in my head trying to think of the word that means the opposite of dorsal. And as I was just like stuck in the moment, all of a sudden I had this mental picture of essentially an algebra equation from my like in my head of my word bank. On one side of the equation, I had a numerator and denominator, and the numerator for that left side was dorsal, and the denominator was back. And then on the right side of the equation, I had the denominator only. The numerator was blank. The denominator was like front or stomach. And then the numerator was the word I couldn't think of. So essentially, I had kind of this balanced equation where I knew that I had the technical biological word, and then a common word in English that fairly well approximated that thought. And so, like with that mental picture, I realized that I'd been thinking about dorsal. Dorsal was the word that was stuck in my head. And so I kept just generating more words about dorsal because I was trying to get to the word that I didn't know on the technical biological side. So instead, I shifted gears kind of to think more about, well, a synonym that I know for this word that I don't know is stomach. And so I started thinking about stomach, and within like 2 seconds, the answer came to my head, which was ventral. And so I said, but or Kasira had mentioned she knew what it was, and I asked her not to tell me. So I said, is it ventral? And she said, yes. And then I looked it up and confirmed it was ventral. So for me, it felt like this breakthrough moment where I had just this moment of clarity where I could actually see the words as like a mathematical equation and then rearrange it to figure out which word I needed to focus on to get the right answer.
So I got to ask though, this is where I get the concept of what happened, but the piece of it that's missing is how did thinking of stomach trigger in your brain that the word you were thinking of starts with a VEN?
I don't think it triggered that the word I was thinking of started with VEN. I think what it triggered is, I guess my understanding of how the brain works is that it's not like a, or I guess it could be thought of as a folder structure, but it's like association. So like, what are the things is this word or this memory associated to? And so when I was thinking of the word dorsal, literally the only association it has with ventral is that it's the antonym for it.
Oh,
So
okay. Okay.
I was generating, my mind was pulling up words with positive associations to dorsal, right? So I was getting other things associated with your back or other like medical terminology or whatever. And then what I realized was I needed something not with an antagonistic or opposite association to dorsal. I needed to think of a word that was a synonym for the word I didn't know so that I could find that positive association.
Okay.
And so then I think as soon as I started thinking about stomach, my mind kind of like my subconscious already knew that I was trying to think of the biological term. And so I think once I've pivoted and started thinking about stomach, it by association was like, oh, here's some other words that are associated with stomach, and
Oh, I
this is
see.
the biological technical word.
So you knew that ventral was associated to the stomach already.
Yes,
That was
I
in your
just
brain.
couldn't, I knew the meaning of it. I just couldn't remember the actual word itself. So I focused on what's the meaning of it, and then my brain pooped out the word after a minute.
Is it accurate to, so I'm still, I think based on what you said, I'm still lost on how thinking of stomach connected the word ventral, or how your brain made that connection. But let me spitball something to you. Is it that you knew, maybe subconsciously or on the tip of your tongue, whatever you want to call it, that ventral was associated with stomach? Okay, you knew that. And you knew that the opposite, you were also looking for the opposite of dorsal. And you kind of, so you that's what you're looking for. You knew that ventral is associated with stomach, but your brain wasn't making the connection between, hey, the opposite of dorsal is stomach, and stomach is associated with ventral, ergo ventral is the antonym to dorsal. Like your brain wasn't making the stomach equals the opposite of dorsal connection. That's where the algebra helped you.
Yeah, I think I would say the way you described it is fairly accurate. Because it's like the knowledge was all there, right? It was just that I couldn't retrieve it from storage to actually spit out what the word was that I knew. And so I think by having that picture in my head of the algebra, I was able to go, okay, dorsal is the specific word. Let's get a more generic word to back in that case, and then what's the opposite of that, front or stomach, and then okay, now I need to go back to the specific technical word. And so I think that was when I was just thinking about dorsal, I was essentially in the wrong folder, right? So I had to go
Yeah.
back up the folder tree and then down it again to
In the
find
wrong
the
folder.
other.
Okay. I think I get you. I think I get you.
But the part that I'm really curious about is if it would be possible to apply the same method, because like I ha that was a mental picture, but I'm wondering, and I haven't had a chance to try it again, but like the next time I can't think of a word that I know, could I try the same approach and make the search go faster, right? Because usually people just say, well, stop trying to think about it, and once you stop thinking about it, it'll come to you.
Right, which is
Which
so
is
annoying.
always annoying. Yeah, because it's like a very passive way of trying to retrieve information. So now my thought was, could I force my brain to find the association faster if I can point it in the right direction?
Man, nature is amazing.
Yeah, pretty interesting.
Yeah, man. Well, good on you. Good on you for figuring that out. And for all of our listener out there, Think about doing the same thing if you ever have trouble finding words, as I so often do.
Or let us know if you've experienced similar situations where you're able to think your way out of a brain fart, if you will.
It's kind of like you, it's not exactly the same, but it's as if you on the spot came up with a mnemonic device for that very word.
Yes.
It's like you came up with a dynamic mnemonic device, which is kind of crazy.
I thank you for bringing that up, because mnemonic devices was part of the topic that I was thinking about as we, you know, prepared this conversation, or said that we were going to talk about this topic. And I was like, yeah, it was a mnemonic that I did not have previously, that I was able to develop a mental model for a mnemonic that pointed me to the word that I needed to remember.
Yeah. Oh,
and
man.
most of it happened without my intentional guidance. Like, the only place that I really had to intentionally dive in was to go, oh, okay, I need to think about stomach. And then once I just like closed my eyes and started thinking about the word stomach, just trying to picture it in my head, it was almost instantaneous that the right word came to mind.
Yeah, okay. Man, I hear mnemonic devices and I can't help but think of Michael Scott's mnemonic devices. Remember that? I color code everything. For example, I have, for this client, I have gay sun written in green. Green means go, as in don't go there.
Yeah. And then he's like, this is highlighted in orange, as in orange, you glad you didn't bring that up.
And then doesn't he say most of my color coding has to do with stuff to not say or something?
Which is, the irony is that he has all these layers to his color coding, but really all that you need to know is if it's highlighted in a color, don't talk about it.
I don't think Michael Scott's thinking that far ahead. Oh, man.
Andrew Bernard would be, though, because he's like a carpenter who works on stairs. Always thinking one step ahead.
Ah.
Oh, man, that's such a good scene.
It is. Well,
so
next topic.
Transitioning from memory algebra, you had a topic that you wanted to talk about related to also biology and specifically human biology.
Yeah. So something that's been like pestering my mind for quite a while is, why are humans so biologically distinct from other animals, particularly other mammals and even primates? Even like among the animals that are close to us on the evolutionary tree, we're pretty darn distinct. Like, if you take a chimpanzee and compare it to like a baboon or a gorilla or like a lemur, it's like, or no, are lemurs close? No, I'm not thinking of lemur.
No.
Bonobo, maybe? But like all these other primates, they're like, they differ a lot in size. They differ a lot like in color, maybe maybe shape of the body or shape of the like head and face. But pretty much everything else about them is the same. They have the same feet patterns, or kind of like, they don't have like, their feet are a lot more like their hands than humans are, right? Mm-hmm. So like, humans' feet are very distinct from our hands. Like, they share similarities, sure, but like, you look at like a chimpanzee and it's like, you see its feet and its hands and it's kind of hard to tell them apart. Our feet are very distinctly our feet compared to our hands. So that's like, why are we the one primate? Maybe there are others out there that I'm unaware of, but why are we like the one primate where we have our feet are very distinct from our hands? Why are we not covered in body hair like a gorilla or any other of the monkeys? I mean, sure, we do technically have body hair, but it's so sparse. It's we're effectively human, you know, sphinxes, right? We got no fur. Except for on
when
top,
you say sphinxes, you're referring to the cats, correct?
Yes, the hairless cats. Except for on top of our head, on our faces, under our armpits, and another area down below. And there's no other primate that's like that. There's barely any other mammals that are like that. Well, there's no other animals are, or excuse me, mammals are, they have fur over their whole body, or they got none. There's really no in between except for people, at least as far as I'm aware. You do have naked mole rats. You do have sphinxes. But when sphinxes were, what's what I'm looking for? Yeah, they were selectively bred. So that didn't happen naturally. But yeah, like we humans are the only ones where we have like hair on top of our head, which is actually kind of just in its of itself weird. And then I don't understand why we have hair under our armpits. On the land down under, I can understand protection, warmth for the organs down there. Sure. I never have understood why we have hair under our armpits. I don't get it.
Yeah, I think there's a functional element, or at least this is what I've heard in the past. In I don't remember if it was science class or just conversation with others, but you end up having the hair there actually is like creates a lower friction surface. So like if you just had dry skin under your armpit rubbing, you'd end up or could end up chafing. And so having a little bit of hair there actually lowers the friction coefficient. And it also helps create just a little bit of separation so that as you're sweating, it still has somewhere to evaporate and can dry off eventually. So
but then,
I don't know if either of those are true, but.
Which I can understand, but if you, like in your feet, right? Like a lot of people's bottoms of their feet, or like on their toes, or like if you're a guitar player on the tip of your fingers, like if you get a lot of excessive wear over time, it'll callus up. It doesn't start sprouting hair to lower friction. Why is it different under our arms?
Well, I mean, guitars haven't been around that long, but I don't know. Good question.
Are you speculating, Ben, that over time guitars will start growing hair out of their fingertips?
Maybe.
Oh,
it's possible.
That'd be kind of cool and really weird. Mostly really weird.
I mean, think about that in the long term. Like, guitarists now get a new nickname. It's like, you don't call them guitarists anymore. They're called hairy fingers.
Yeah. Hairy fingers. You have to shave your fingertips every morning.
Yeah.
Hey, it'd help you be a good criminal because then your fingerprints would kind of be easier to conceal.
Yeah.
Grab things with your fingertip hair.
But I also don't know because, I mean, it's not at a joint, right? That's an interface between your finger and other materials, but the amount of time where your fingertip contacts something else, even if you're a guitarist doing it a lot, is not that much versus like an armpit. It's continuous, right? For basically every member of the species.
Yeah. But then again, it should just callus up really quick. I don't understand why it starts sprouting hair.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well,
actually, the part that's weird about that is hair is normally associated with insulation, right?
Yeah.
And so why would it be insulating an area that's actually a heat sink?
Right.
You want heat to be able to escape.
I don't know, man. It's really throwing me for a loop. I just don't understand it. And that's just one aspect of how humans are distinct. Like really distinct among mammals, particularly. Or I shouldn't say particularly. I'll say at least. Because obviously we're distinct from crocodiles. But so, you know,
right.
But mammals are distinct from reptiles. That kind of makes sense. But it's like even amongst mammals, we're really weird in a lot of ways.
So I was just looking at what other mammal species are hairless or have very little hair. And the biggest group are cetaceans, which would be whales, dolphins, porpoises, and so on.
Yep.
Which makes sense, right? They don't need hair. I don't know of any fish or aquatic mammals that have hair. And then the other ones seem to be, there's like walruses, hippos, elephants, I think rhinos even. So the trend seems to be massive, heavily fattened mammals.
And we're neither.
But even that, right, and even that doesn't account for like horses or cows or
Tigers, which are way bigger, or lions, which are way bigger than humans.
bears. I don't know. There's a bunch of large, very hairy mammals that are also heavily fattened.
Yeah. And the thing is, the ones that
So.
are hairless, like they're pretty much completely hairless. It's not like you see a rhino with a full head of hair, or it's got like,
Right,
a really big
right.
lush like wave in the middle of its back or something, because that's where it grows a patch of hair for some unknown reason. It's either
Although,
all hair or no hair. And humans are
I
like
mean,
one of the very few exceptions.
you kind of got like horses have manes, right? Or lions' manes. Like, I guess those for a lion is like display purposes or making it appear larger than it is. But I don't know about a horse's mane, what purpose that serves.
That's true. I would agree with that. I would agree that it seems like, odd. Like, why is that there? But still, it has fur everywhere else. It has just different type
Yeah.
of fur on the back of its neck.
Yeah, I was just thinking of that as like a comp for a localized difference in either the hair type or length or whatever.
For a very seemingly like lack of a practical reason. Like their tail is, there's a lot of hair there that's localized and much different than the rest of their body. Because I don't think a horse's tail, like the actual fleshy part of it, is very long. I think it's more like a stump. And then the mo most of the
Right.
of a horse's tail is just hair that hangs down and is long. But that has a practical purpose for communication or swapping flies away or swatting flies away. But yeah, the manes, like what is it? You know what? I'm gonna look this up. Let's look this up. What purpose does a horse's mane have? Every
This has
horse's
got
mane
me.
and tail are unique and serve some very important functions. Manes can help keep your horse's neck warm in cold weather and provide some fly protection.
But then why not the rest of it?
Yeah, maybe. Hold on. Horses have manes to provide shade on hot, sunny days and insulate their neck on cold days, and it acts as a natural fly screen. Manes also offer a layer of protection from predators' teeth, and long forelocks shade the horse's eyes from the sun and from flies. Huh.
Those feel like, I'll just say, fairly contrived reasons to have that sort of a feature. Like, we observe this feature and we go, huh, well, I guess they have to be there for some reason, so keeping away flies.
Yeah. And I don't really see, because the thing is, these features, right? The whole point of evolution is there's some aspect of the animal that mutates randomly. But that mutation, if it's beneficial, will help that specific specimen survive and mate and spread its genes. And as the genes spread and those offspring are more likely to survive, they will eventually outpace the animals that don't have that mutation.
Right.
So
It
the
has survival utility.
right it ha and then that's how the mutation spreads. However, what I don't understand is how, like, kind of like a horse's mane, I can't see that being a s beneficial enough feature where that would where that where its presence would make or break a horse's survival on enough Kate instances to then be prolific throughout the whole gene pool. Now it's possible,
Right.
and this is me spitballing, I'm not a geneticist or biologist or a zoologist, so I'm none of those things. So take my what I'm about to say with just a whole shaker full of salt. But maybe if a mutation isn't necessarily beneficial, it's just sort of there and it doesn't really make a difference one way or the other. But if it's a very dominant gene, then it's just gonna sort of statistically speaking spread, but it's gonna maybe take over, if that's the right word, or
Yeah.
be presenting, that's the word. So yeah, like, one horse mutated some time ago, developed a mane, and the mane didn't really help it. I mean, sure, it helps you swap flies away, helps keep it shaded, but I doubt that's big enough to, you know, it's not a life or death thing. It's nice, but just eventually that horse made babies and those babies carried the genes. And then they had babies with horses that didn't have manes, but then the gene that mutates, or the gene that does enable the mane, just, you know, in the baby of the mane and non-mane parents, that gene comes in and says, hey, buddy, I'm in charge now. We're having a mane.
Yeah.
Because there's... Although, Sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, one of the trends that I was just thinking about is all the large animals that don't have hair, that don't live in the water, most of them are in Africa or, like, subtropical region. So it's very hot, which would kind of make sense. They don't need insulation. And in a lot of cases, yeah, they're probably balancing. Like, if there was going to be hair to shade them, it would also be hair that's going to cause an overheat. But as you were talking, the whole dominant versus recessive thing got me thinking, I know how that works in terms of the mathematics of, like, over time, you know, a dominant trait is going to win out in these different conditions, like, unless both of the parents have a recessive trait. But what is it that gives a specific gene sequence? What is it, or recessive? Like, do we actually know what causes that, or can we only say that they're dominant or recessive based on how they expand or shrink in the population over time?
Oh, like, can we actually analyze a gene to see if something's dominant or not? Or do we have to just wait and, as you said, observe the population with that gene to see, well, it must be recessive or it must be dominant because this is what we're seeing in the population?
Right. Like, is there anything at the genetic level where we can go in and say, you know, it's like we're watching this dominant recessive gene duke it out, and the dominant gene is just like this hulking, you know, like Mike Tyson, and the recessive gene is, you know, genetically weaker and just can't compete? Or what is it specifically about the gene that makes them dominant or recessive, other than observation?
So I think I just searched, like, how do we know if a gene is dominant or recessive? And I haven't read this article yet, obviously, because I looked at it about 3 seconds ago, but let's see what it says. In order for a person to show the dominant trait, one of the person's parents must have the dominant trait. Remember that human cells carry two copies of each chromosome, one from the biological mother's genes. If a person carries a heterozygous set of alleles, oh, this is getting too buzzwordy. That doesn't really answer the question. That just says what happens, you know, if a gene is dominant. What about this one? What's the difference between a dominant versus recessive? The example, this is probably just going to, again, a lot of these articles are not getting to the spirit of our question. They're more of asking if you have a dominant, if a gene is dominant or if it is recessive, what's going to happen? Or what happens if a dominant and a recessive gene, cross paths? Obviously, the dominant's going to win. They're not really asking, or they're not really answering the why that happens, or how can we tell if it's dominant or not. I would guess biologically, when the gene is read by your body, that it's more or less just checking, hey, you know, you have two alleles, I think is how it works. We see that one's recessive. They don't, well, that's the thing, right? It's not asking the gene, are you recessive or dominant? It's just checking for something. I'm guessing if those checks are something like, if one of the two alleles has X trait, go with X. That is what then X would be a dominant trait. So as long as one of them are that, then that's what we're going to go with. Recessive must be if the reader's saying, if neither of these are X, then go with Y.
So I found an article that, so there's a lot of, it can vary, causes can vary from a lot of different reasons, but one of the most common ones is if the recessive gene is a broken protein. So they give the example of red hair. So the their There's a protein called, it says MC1R, and one of its usual jobs is to get rid of red pigment. When it isn't working, you get a buildup of red pigment and end up with red hair. So it says all it takes to keep from having red hair is to have a little bit of the MC1R protein. So it's easy to see why red hair is recessive. As long as you have one working MC1R gene, you won't have red hair. So
Oh, so
this
it's
obviously may not always be the case, but so essentially what it takes to have red hair is both of your red hair control or red pigment control genes are busted. So you have no way to prevent the buildup of red pigment.
But you if you
But
have a dominant and a recessive, or if you have a working gene and a non-working gene, you'll have some functionality. And
right,
that
and so you
sum
will
is
still
enough to just get rid of the red pigment.
right.
Okay, interesting.
The
Oh.
dominant versus recessive might just be like the dominant ones are the ones that are fully functional, and recessive ones are ones that got mutated to some point where they can't fully function, right?
Yeah,
And so,
they break some function. Okay.
yeah, which would kind of make sense, right?
I actually, so this is triggering something in my brain. I actually have a blood disorder called beta thalassemia minor, and it's the actual disorder is like the symptoms are so minor, like you don't know that you have it until you get a blood test because it has no effect on your life. I think it makes you slightly anemic, like just all the time, and you can't. It's not a matter you're not getting enough iron. It has to do with how your blood processes the iron that you're getting. It just can't do as good enough job as normal blood. Anyway, and that's due to a recessive gene. If I have a kid with someone who also has this disorder, then there's a 25% chance that that kid will get both of the busted genes, one from me, one from the mom, and then have beta thalassemia major, which is really bad. Your body can't produce its own hemoglobin, and you need blood transfusions for the rest of for your whole life.
Wow.
Sadly enough, though, it apparently your body produces two different kinds of hemoglobin in your lifetime. Your body apparently produces what's called fetal hemoglobin up until you're about 6 months old, and then it switches production to adult hemoglobin. And this beta thalassemia disorder affects only the adult hemoglobin. So the baby's fine for the first 6 months of his life. And then when its
Wow.
body switches, okay, we're going to start producing adult hemoglobin, and we can't do that. Guess we'll die. So it's
Dang.
like you don't find out until the baby's 6 months old and it starts getting really sick really fast, apparently. So not good.
Is that something they can do screening for or testing for in advance?
Yes, so I found out through a blood test. This was a handful of years ago, and then I went to get like a physical or something, and they did blood work, and then they said, "Hey, we saw something interesting on your results that we wanted to talk to you about." And I said, "Is it my anemia?" Well, I think they said, so let me back up. They said, "Hey, we got your results. We found something interesting that you're gonna need to hear about." I said, "Oh, snap! What is it?" And they said something like, "Are you anemic by chance?" They said, "Oh, yeah, I have this disorder called, beta thalassemia minor." And they said, "Oh, well, that's what we're going to tell you about. Oh, I already knew about that. Oh, okay." And then so that was a relief. But yeah,
Yeah, I'm
so
sure.
I bring that example up because, right, I do have a recessive and a dominant in that case. The dominant is the proper hemoglobin production gene. The broken gene is what results in my condition. But as you said with the red hair, right? If you have a broken recessive gene, or let's rephrase that. If you have a broken gene where it's the function that that gene controls is not, is either completely, well, I got to be careful here how we word this. You have two sets of genes. I think for every gene that you have two sets. You have one allele from your mom, one allele from your dad, and your body reads them both. If one of those alleles is mutated so that the thing that reads it And is using that gene to give it direction on how to perform some function. If that gene is broken, and then the function can't happen anymore, then it's really reading from two different genes, and it's going to say, okay, from the mom's gene, we're going to produce 50 units of hemoglobin, whatever, and then for the dad's gene, we're going to produce 50 units of hemoglobin. Well, the mom's gene is busted. So her share of the units, her 50 units, we can't make. But we can produce the 50 units from the dad. So, Jack, I guess you're not getting 100 units of hemoglobin, you're only getting 50. And that's fine. You can live with that. It's the same thing with the red hair protein. Right? You're not getting the full blast of the protein, but you're going to get enough where you'll still not have red hair at the end of the day. But if they're both busted, then you're getting zero.
Right.
So it's, I think the dominant versus recessive is, it's not actually an on-off switch. It's a, if they're both working, the switch is fully on. If one of them's broken, your switch is only 50% on. And then if they're both broken, the switch is 100% off. So it's like, think of it like a one of those dial switches that you can increase or decrease the level of light coming from a lamp. If you're trying to read, right, having the light on at full bore, you'll be able to read. That's enough light. It's probably more than enough light. If you reduce it to 50%, well, you still have light to read by. That's probably more than enough light to read by. But if the switch is completely off, then you can't read. I think that's what's going on.
Yeah, I think there's, I guess, maybe another nuance that comes to mind, which is like if you have different devices that take AA batteries, for example, right? Like a lot of remotes take two AA batteries. But there are other devices that take two that aren't remotes. And in some of those situations, depending on how it's wired and how much juice the thing requires, you can have one where you need both batteries in place to get any function whatsoever. And there are some where if you only have one battery, it still works. It's just going to last half as long
Or be half as strong.
or be half as strong, right? But so I think there's a component of that too, just depending on, like you said, I guess the mechanism by which it's reading, where in some cases, having one of the alleles not functional at all might not be problematic. They might just say, well, we only need one, we'll keep the good one, truck the other one, right?
Yeah.
But there are some cases where it's looking for two and it needs both to be fully functional. And then it's a question of if you don't get both, does it cease function or do you get, marginal function or whatever, right? But I
Yeah.
think that causes some of the complexity of the different scenarios as things play out through the gene pool.
Yeah, it might be where the reader just says, if one of these is working, then we're good. Then that's all we need. It might be where the reader doesn't care. It's not actually comparing them. It's just saying, we're going to read one gene, produce that many units of whatever, or do so many things, and then read the other one and do that many. And then if one of them's busted, you're really only getting half the functionality.
Right.
But that functionality, that might be enough. That might be above the threshold that you need to meet the intent or the desired effect anyway. You know what? Your remote examples are really good. It is really good because if you take one battery out of the remote and you, or if you put a dead one in place of one, so it's still acting as a conductor and you only have half the voltage, your remote still will function. It'll work just fine. I mean, maybe its range will be decreased, but if you're sitting in
Right.
your normal place, you don't really care because you're close enough where it doesn't matter. Oh, that's a really good example, Ben. That's an ex that's a good
Thank you.
example of only like the of how having a dominant versus recessive, or maybe put in other terms, a working versus broken gene, how the dominant one is dominant and takes over. I like that. I'm going to use that, and if this question ever comes up again.
Store that one away for later.
Yeah.
And if you forget that you've had this analogy stuck in your head, you can use the dynamic mnemonic to
Yes.
recall it. Get right back to it.
I remember genes and dominance had something to do with batteries and remotes. If you remove one gene, or you remove a battery, the remote still works, the gene still works. Hey!
Nailed it.
There we go. So this was all a tangent on our original topic, which is humans being so biologically diverse from other animals. And the thing that we left off on was hair, because we were talking about horses and the genes being mutations and how is it really that beneficial. I do at some point, we don't have to do it now. Maybe this is another topic we can put on the list, but there are some features, right? A lot of the topic of evolution is there's a random mutation, and if it's benef if it only hurts the animal, then that animal is gonna not survive. Or if it does manage to make offspring, those offspring aren't gonna survive or have a higher chance of dying, and the gene will die out just over time because the animals with that gene can't, they don't make it. But
And
if a gene is
what
beneficial, then okay, then those animals and the offspring will survive and they'll proliferate and they'll kind of take over. But what happens when a mutation is neither good nor bad? It's just sort of different. How does that spread?
well, so what one thing I was going to say is I think sometimes when you're having that conversation, the survival utility or benefit is thought of at the individual level, but I think it makes a lot more sense big picture. If you're saying across a whole population, maybe the like for example horse tails, maybe a single horse isn't going to die any earlier if it can't swat flies away, right? Like maybe it lives in an area where there aren't flies, or it never gets bitten by a fly with any disease or whatever. But across the population, if you've got a million horses, how many of those are going to die earlier because they couldn't swat flies away or whatever, right? So I think
Oh, I see.
I think that's helpful in understanding the spread of the genes. It's not necessarily that any it's going to cause it's not that it's necessarily going to shorten the lifespan of any single animal. It's that the probability of their lifespan being shortened is higher across the population.
And then just over time, even if it's a very small, very minute benefit, it will sort of over time just sort of grow.
Right,
And
because
through the
say like
generations, right? Okay.
the horse with a good tail versus a horse with no tail survives, or like survives like 5% longer on average. Well, any individual horse might live to be as long as the other, but if you've got that distribution that's now bimodal, right? Say it's right if it survives 5% longer, that fraction of the population is going to expand. It may not be linear at 5%, but it's going to be some growth rate is it's going to split from 50% to 55 to 60 to 70, whatever.
I see. Yeah, because just that little bit of extra time across the whole population for more breeding and producing offspring will that for that first generation, if you can even say that, is going to give them a little bit of an edge, and then the next generation is going to be
Right.
even have more of an edge, so they'll produce even more. And I see. Yeah, that could
Right.
be.
And it's you get multiple effects, right? Because it's both the first generation has more time to reproduce, and then the second generation, in all likelihood, is going to end up with a more concentrated form of that genetic mutation, right? So it's going to, if that mutation survived, it probably got stronger because the likelihood of both parents having that mutation is higher.
But what about things that are really like purely unbeneficial, like eye color, blue versus brown eyes? That's not gonna help our survivability.
Well, there are differences, right? People with blue eyes are more light sensitive. Is that right? So like if someone with blue eyes and somebody with brown eyes walk outside on a sunny day, I think it's the person with blue eyes is going to have to squint a lot more than the person with brown eyes.
Oh, so that's interesting. So the mutation, or the like one genetic or one aspect of that animal that is controlled. So let me take a step back. So mutations may come in packages. One gene may affect two different things, and one of those things may not be beneficial or disadvantageous. but it's sort of along for the ride for the other aspect that is advantageous. And then that helps the animal, or helps the population with that mutation proliferate and take over the population. And then this other aspect is just sort of there.
Right, which I think you could say in this way of like, and I don't know if this is actually how it works, but hypothetically, if you're talking about blue versus brown eyes, you could say it's not the color of the eyes that provides any sort of survival utility, but it's rather the how effective the pigment is at absorbing light before it hits your retina or whatever, right? I don't know if that's what causes that higher level of sensitivity or not. But so it's something associated with the color difference, but it's not the specific color difference itself, right? If you had something of the same like level of opacity or opaqueness, maybe it would have the same survival utility in a different color.
Well, I think the iris, the color of your eye makes a good example of this, because the colored part of your eye is not what is absorbing the light and making you sensitive. It's the, because those are the rods and cones in the back of your eyeball. Whereas the iris color is completely, as far as I know, which I could be wrong. We both could be wrong about this. We have no idea what we're talking about. This is just two guys spitballing stuff. So if there are people listening to this who are like screaming at whatever they're listening with, like their headset or something or their phone, because we're getting stuff so completely wrong, hey, give us a break. We're just sitting here chatting away. We're wondering about this stuff. If you know better, then let us know. Like, put it in the comments or something.
So what I wasn't saying that. What I was saying is, I was imagining that your iris is like window tint, right?
Yeah.
And so a brown eye might have a darker window tint than a blue eye. It's still not the thing receiving or processing the light, but it might be changing or filtering the amount of light that gets through to the processor.
I get that point, but with the iris specifically, we know that's not what's going down. So the iris color, because the reason why I brought it up is because your iris color is, it's got to be so inconsequential to your survivability that how could that mutation sprout up and just spread besides just random chance, like blue eyes, for example. I think we're a somewhat recent mutation. And we see blue-eyed people quite frequently because it's had time just to spread. But it's not like it's taking over the brown-eyed folks or the green-eyed folks. And it really statistically shouldn't, because it offers no benefit. So if blue eyes did suddenly become the dominant trait, dominant, not genetically, but just like there's more blue-eyed people than there are brown and green, how would that have happened? Because it's not offering benefit. So it can't explain, that can't explain why it's spreading so much. I'm going on a rant. All I'm trying to get to is there are some traits that seem to me, at least, to be wholly so neutral and so inconsequential that, see, I guess I don't, you know what, it's just weird.
Well, so here again, though, I mean,
it's weird how, I got it.
Recessive, right?
Hold on, I got it. Before I want to say it before I lose it. It's, there are some traits that are common across the whole population that seem to not be either they seem to be this neutral sort of trait. So how did they take over? That's my question. And blue eyes is not a good example of that, because blue eyes haven't taken over. But things, I'm trying to think of one off the top of my head. I'm not good at that. But
so I can build on this.
Okay.
So blue eyes are actually recessive. So brown eyes are the dominant trait. Greens in the middle. So over the long term, you'd expect, if humans survived indefinitely, you'd expect eventually everyone to have brown eyes. But I think, again, if this came back to, is one of the alleles broken, right? It could be that in order, like, your eyes are looking for two brown eye alleles. If one of them's broken, you get green. And if both of them are broken, you get blue. or something along those lines. But that, I mean, it's, I guess to answer your question, I feel like there's a component of that spreading that's just simply the dominance or recessiveness of the gene independent of its survivability, right? I think you could have a dominant gene that actually hurts your survival prospects. I don't think the biological genetic level dominance or recessive trait of a gene is tied in any way to whether or not that's a beneficial trait to have.
Oh, yeah, I would agree with that. And I would guess that in those cases where there is a mutation on a dominant gene that is harmful towards the creature, that it would, that creature or that line is probably gonna die off.
Yeah, that's like a guaranteed rapid exit, right?
Yeah. The problem, right, is, ooh, you know what? Though, so my initial thought was it'll die out, I would think. But the problem is the dominance of that gene is going to kind of fight the dying off process, so it's just going to take longer because the it's a dominant gene, it's going to always affect the offspring, whereas a recessive gene might not.
Right, but it's always affecting the offspring with a harm or a gene trait that's harmful for their survival. So having a combination of a dominant gene with that causing a negative survival outcome is actually going to accelerate their demise.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's going to accelerate the demise of the whole species because if a dominant mutated dad and a recessive unmutated mom have babies, all of the babies are doomed. Or at least,
Yeah,
have
right.
a hampered
Lesser
chances of
chance.
survivability, yeah. And now
Right.
all of those babies, so it's kind of like a virus. Now all those babies I can only ever have doomed babies.
Right. Yeah, and that was the comparison I was going to draw, is it kind of depends on, like, when you're looking at the transmissibility of a virus, it's both a matter of the mortality rate and, or sorry, the whether or not it kills off a population is a matter of how transmissible it is and the mortality rate, right? Because it can be something that's super transmissible but not doesn't really have an impact on mortality, like a cold, or it can be something like, why can't I think of the one that spread
Rabies?
over? Oh, no, Ebola, right? Where you actually have to have contact with the bodily fluid of an infected person. But it's like 60%+ mortality rate. I guess the point I was making is that somewhere in there is the line of what actually happens. And you can get, I could imagine, similar to a virus, that you could get one that spreads, it's so dominant and it's so negative that it actually kills itself off before it can spread to the whole population.
I would think so
You know
too.
what I mean?
That's a good point. Yeah. Whereas the recessive gene, right, it would sort of linger in the population
Yeah,
because you could have silent carriers that are fine and survive and produce offspring that pass on the gene. And some of those babies might have double recessive genes and die off, but all of their siblings have the recessive gene, but maybe not double recessive, so they continue the trend. Oh, maybe that's why a lot of disorders are recessive, because being recessive helps the disorder proliferate because it can kind of hide and not kill off its host before it produces offspring. Yeah, this seems like it's the same mechanism as viruses that mutate over time to be less mortal again or less fatal against their host, because the ones that are fatal to their host kill their host, and oh shoot, now I don't have any way to transmit myself to other hosts and spread guess I'll die, just like my host. And then
Right.
the ones that do mutate to a less fatal variant, well, now they're not killing their hosts off. Their hosts are up walking around transmitting the virus, and that virus can spread. Because I know that's what's happening with corona. A lot of people, I shouldn't say speculating. I think we're noticing that the mortality rate's going down, and it's either confirmed or it's probably because it's mutating to a less fatal strain. So now people are less afraid to go out and about, and more people are getting COVID, but it's not as big a deal because it's mutated to a less fatal variant. Oh.
It's,
So
yeah, I mean, it's the classic predator-prey relationship, right? Like wolves in an environment that will grow in population until they can't be sustained. They're killing off too much prey, and then they starve, right? And they die back down, and it's all the same type of give and take.
very interesting. So we just linked viral spread with like dominant versus recessive genes. Very intriguing. That's an interesting mechanic. Very interesting mechanic. Nature is amazing.
And the real question is, which is the dominant or recessive between Levi Strauss and Wrangler? I haven't figured that one out yet.
What do you mean?
For dominant or recessive genes.
Oh no, I just got it. That took me too long. Well, how do we tell, right? Hold on, let's think about this. If we wanted to figure out whether Levi Strauss or Wrangler is the dominant gene versus which one's the recessive gene, how would we figure that out? Would we have to like splice them together and see what we get?
Yeah, I think so. I'm picturing like Levi Strauss jorts with Wrangler calves.
Oh no. I was thinking you literally split them in half vertically and sort of, well, I actually know. I originally was thinking was like you de-thread them and then thread them together, thread by threads. You'd end up with two pair of pants, but they'd both be like every other thread would be from a Wrangler
Oh,
versus something like
wow.
that.
At the fabric level.
Yeah, like what would and what well, hold on. I think so. How do we splice them is one question. The other, I think the more interesting question is how do we determine, what are the criteria for determining whether one of the, which one's dominant, which one's recessive?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Because we have
Because
to
I think.
model that after how genes are manifested in animals.
So I think you'd have to splice them every way you can think of. So you could do vertically, horizontally, or front to back.
And
Or
on a
even
fabric
the
level.
fabric, and the fabric, sure. And then you make a bunch of pairs of those and hand them out at random and then see with those people after 6 months or a year or whatever and see which sets are still being worn, if there are any trends in, was the Wrangler tops did better and that's a dominant trade over the Levi tops?
Yeah, because it would have to be maybe. Well, I was going to say it has to be the one that survives the longest, maybe, would be a good criteria. Survives either in it doesn't wear out as fast, or people don't say, oh, these genes are pieces of crap. I'm going to throw them out.
Right. Because I
But.
think we're assuming that we wouldn't end up with more pairs of jeans. There wouldn't be, breeding between the pairs of pants.
I could just imagine some colonists. Yeah, my genes just spontaneously spliced into two smaller sets of genes. Should I be worried?
Could you
No, that's
imagine if
perfectly normal. Happens all the time.
you open your dresser drawer one morning and like when you went to bed, you had all your jeans folded like in your drawer for the week, and then you get up in the morning and there's just a pair of like baby sized jeans that are like sitting there next to it. That actually be a really funny prank to play on someone. Just get baby sized versions of all their stuff and put one in each drawer, like when they're on vacation or something.
So here's the question: would a mommy genes and a daddy genes, when they love each other very much, produce a baby genes, or the baby genes like bud off of the parent genes, sort of like a mushroom or something? You know what I mean? How would it reproduce?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, there are dad genes and mom genes. Those are a thing, so
That's
kind
true.
of seems like that would be the way of things.
And there are baby jeans, or at least baby overalls, in the world, so.
Yeah. Thanks, Oshkosh B'gosh.
Hold on. I'm
Wow.
fixated on this now. How do we determine which gene is dominant? Because I was going to say, right, we take the ones that. Oh, I see. So, like, let's say we're doing top and bottom, right? So you take a Wrangler and you take a Levi, and the Levi's, we're going to take the top, we're going to start with the top of the Wrangler and go down to maybe mid thigh, and then cut them off, so basically like jorts, and then we sew on Levi, or the other one, whichever one I said first, legs, right? And then we take another pair and we do the opposite, where the top is the opposite brand and the bottoms, and then we do that a bunch of times, hand it out to a big population. And then do we, okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I would say that's a good, okay. I get
That's the
you, yeah.
closest I can come to approximating the mechanic. I don't know how
Which,
else you do it.
yeah, which one is going to proliferate and which ones are going to die off? Oh, that's more advent. Hold on. This is more advent. Which is the advantageous gene versus the disadvantageous gene? Not if it's
Yeah,
dominant or not.
I suppose it's true.
Ooh, dominant. So if we're going with how people use slash wear the jeans, hear me out. This is just me spitballing. Maybe we can give them a choice. Which would you want to wear? You have to pick one or the other, but you get to pick which one you get. Are there any trends in that?
Sure.
Or
Yeah,
would,
that's
like,
plausible.
80% of the time, are they going to pick the Levi Strauss tops?
And so maybe everybody picks the Levi tops. But the Wranglers last longer.
Right. Oh, so then that's the dominant but disadvantageous question.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. I like
And
this.
meanwhile, everyone who wears those jeans out in public or to their job gets fired.
I like this.
Actually, that'd be a really interesting way for, like, say Levi wanted to know how their like the bottoms of their pants hold up versus Wranglers. That'd be a really interesting way for them to do it, because you could it'd be like a form of benchmarking, but you could put your bottoms on their tops so that like people who normally buy their jeans would now be wearing them the same way, but with your bottoms on.
I was going to ask, like, why not just wear two different pair of jeans, but Levi and a Wrangler, but that's a good point. You want to take out all the variables that you can. So
Is
yeah,
that
you
like
can just talk.
where you put them both on at the same time, like one over top of the other? So
No.
you'd put your left leg in the right leg of a Levi, and you put your right leg in the left leg of a Wrangler. You'd walk around with your butt hanging out and
I'm a trendsetter.
two extra jean legs flopping along.
It's the new hot, hip thing.
You got a belt that goes through both pairs of jeans, and it's like buckled around your, yeah,
We call them
groin.
jeanses.
Jesus. This is what it really means to have pairs of jeans.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
I think we're onto something. That'd be quite the thing to see.
We sneak it in as a way to analyze, which one's the dominant versus recessive gene. And then what we're really trying to do is get the genes' fashion trend off to a good start.
And I mean, we'd have Big Denim would be backing us, right? Because they could sell twice as many pairs.
That's right.
So I think there's a real business model there.
Yep. Oh,
Actually,
dude.
why don't more companies, because fashion trends are all fabricated, so why don't they fabricate trends that sell more fabric? That seems like an easy way to boost profits. So you can either sell more items or sell items that contain more in them.
Ooh, hold on. Hold on. People don't buy clothes based on how much fabric they have, right? I think you have it backwards. Because the thing is, if you buy a pair of jeans, how much does a pair of jeans go for today? I haven't bought jeans in quite a while. I don't know,
It
50.
depends. I'd say they're like 25 at the low end.
Okay, let's just say 30, round number. $30 for a pair of jeans. Would it behoove the jean manufacturers to use twice as much fabric and sell them for 60? Or would it behoove them to use half as much fabric and still sell them for $30?
Well, yeah, so I wasn't necessarily arguing that they should put more fabric into the same item, but in the style we were talking about was actually two pairs of jeans that would be worn simultaneously. So in that case, the person had to purchase two items. So I guess it's not necessarily a function of how much fabric it is. It's a function of how many items did they purchase.
Yeah, but if you're effectively making one item into two, right? So you're selling it as this two item pairing as a unit. You're going to actually sell a lot less of them if you just double the cost. Because somebody says, why would I pay $60 for two pair of jeans? Why would I pay $60 for one jeanses if I can just pay $30 for one jeans? And because I can only wear one, I'm only wearing one or the other at a time.
Because fashion. You can wear both at the same time.
But see, when it comes to fashion, right, they want to say this is the new in thing. You should pay more money for it. They should be reducing the amount of fabric that so the costs go down.
Right, yeah. So they should be basically selling things that contain less fabric, so like undergarments or bikinis or whatever, but then advocating that you wear multiples of them at the same time. That would be the ultimate. So
Okay.
like if they could talk you into wearing like six socks, right, at the same time, maybe like you start putting socks on your hands or something, I don't know. Ear socks.
Your socks.
But then they could still they it's something that doesn't require much fabric. They're selling you at a high profit margin, but now they just got you to buy six instead of two.
True. And then
Or like they
while
may.
they're making those socks, they want to reduce the fabric so that they're lowering the cost. But they can still convince
Right.
you to buy six of them.
Yeah, maybe it's like pocket socks. So the trend is you have a sock hanging out of every pocket.
Oh my God. What a dweeb.
I'm just really trying to think, how can you sell the most number of items to someone and tell them it's fashion?
I like it.
Pocket socks. Look for it
Jeanses.
next year in Paris.
Hey, if you buy a jeanses, think how many pocket socks you can have in that bad boy.
Yeah, you could pair up those marketing campaigns.
Oh man. Now we're on a roll.
Oh man. Well, I think we've successfully exhausted the tangents on that topic.
I still think, well, that one maybe, but I think we could still talk about biological different like unique weather.
Unique New
Unique you
York.
yeah unique I was gonna say unique ularities, but that's not a word.
Uniquities?
Uniquities, is that the word? Like things that are unique?
No, I don't think so. Because you're trying to say like multiple uniquenesses, right?
Yeah, like the I still want to talk about the things that make humans so unique slash okay. We still have the topic of the distinction, like the distinctions between humans and other animals, and how there's actually quite a lot of them, and like more so than you pick any two animals in the animal in the mammal kingdom, the amount of differences between them, I think, would be less. How do I one word this? I think if you were to pit any two mammals against each other, and what are the differences? What are the similarities? The lists. If you once you get to a human, the list of differences between them and anything else, that list would be a lot bigger, or at least on really up near the top of the list than all the possible different combinations and comparisons that you can find.
So like a shrew and a walrus.
Right. There's a lot of differences. But then you pit a human, that would probably be a relatively big list, but a cat for like a house cat versus a tiger, or a house cat versus a wolf, or a house cat versus a weasel, or a like a I don't know, a dolphin versus a rhino. Like all those differences, there's going to be a list, and some will be short, some will be long. But as soon as you get to a human, you compare that to all the different animals, that list is on the average, I think, going to be considerably long, longer than your average. You know what I'm trying to say?
So what would be a difference that comes to mind that would make you say that?
Well, the body hair, where it's not like we don't have no hair, like a rhino or a elephant, where they have like some little body hairs, kind of like what you'd find on your arm, but it's like that really light hair cover all over. They don't also have a full head of hair like us, or have beard hair on their faces, or even have distinct kinds of hair versus like on their, like we have our facial hair and our body hair is one type of hair, and then the hair on top of our head is another kind of hair. Like two different kinds of hair. Kind of like a horse. Horses have that with their body hair versus their mane hair and tail hair. They have two different kinds of hair, but horses are covered in fur. We're not. You can't see a lot of bare skin on a horse. Humans, it's all bare skin except for the head and the face if the dude has facial hair. Other aspects are our intelligence, and that has a whole lot of baggage with it. We're bipedal. What else? Are you trying to get me to say the other item that we had on our list?
I wasn't trying to get you to say, I was giving you an opportunity to bring it up.
Okay, so another
Oh.
item on this differences list are humans are really the only animals that have to wipe after we poop. Like, no other animal does it. Some of them have to do a little bit of cleaning, but not to the extent that humans do. Like, humans are on a whole nother level. Like, why is that? That seems a little unfair. Even other primates don't have to do it.
Okay, but is that not just because we're the only animals that wear clothes?
I don't think so, dude. Because if you were to not wipe, and even if you just walk around sitting on stuff naked, and that's just what we did, there'd be poop smear place.
Yeah, I would there.
I think so. Or we'd have like poop like running down like the back of our legs and cheeks and stuff. Oh.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like mostly we do it. Well, it's hard to say because most people I know aren't running around without wiping and without clothes on, but it seems like mostly we protect the things that we're wearing from getting poo on them. I don't know if that would be necessary if you weren't wearing clothes.
I think it would still manifest in not good ways.
Actually, I'll bet they're like if you found like rural tribes, like indigenous tribes somewhere in the Amazon or sub-Saharan Africa, right, that haven't been exposed to a lot of modern technology and stuff, do they still wipe universally? Are there groups that don't wipe?
That's a good question. Or like, how do they do it?
Yeah, because
Yeah.
I know in a lot of places that, I guess wiping is relative because I would say cleaning is more generic, right? Because in Europe, a lot of people have bidets, so they're not wiping. But in places that don't have access to that level of technology or maybe that standard of living, they may use their hand, right? That was why being left-handed was so bad for such a long time because people used their left hand to wipe. And some places they still do. That's why you would shake hands with your right or whatever.
Right. Ugh, it's so weird.
Yeah, I'm not a fan. But having said that, I don't know. I feel like if we got ourselves a herd of humans, let them run around in some fields, not have to worry about clothes, maybe they wouldn't need to wipe.
Actually, you know what? This is an example of one of those going back to the genetic thing again, like the messiness of our butts after we poop and the fact that we need to clean it up. That seems like whatever genes are resulting in that, like that's a disadvantageous trait because that can lead to disease really easily. Like before we had ways of really cleaning the microbes off of our fingers, like that stuff is poisonous that comes out of us back there, man. And if we have to take care of that with our hands and eat with those same hands, like there's a high chance we're going to get sick and die. So how come that trait never, not only never got bred out of our system, it actually got bred in because it's not present with all the other mammals, which means that whatever genes control that had to come in later and get introduced, and yet we still thrived. So how did, you know what I mean? Like it seems like we survived and became the top of the food chain despite that mutation, not because of it. So how did that come along for the ride and not kill us all off? And this is an example of how some traits could still come out, or mutations can come into the gene pool and they are disadvantageous, but there are maybe other aspects that are propelling that population forward. So the negative mutations come along for the ride because they aren't strong enough to overcome the other beneficial effects. So they stick around, and that's why they're still here. Such as having to need to wipe our butts after we poop.
You know, that just got me thinking about why there isn't. I guess maybe it's just the way that we classify things. So we classify things so that there isn't any overlap. But I was just thinking about, like, you know, humans don't have much hair. But what if every hair on your arm was a feather? Like humans had a bunch of feathers. And I was like, why don't any mammals have feathers? So I was doing a little bit of reading about that, but there's some traits about specific groups where it's like, I mean, birds need feathers to fly, so I understand why they would have feathers versus hair. But what's stopping a mammal from having feathers if it's for insulation and keeping flies away, right? Seems like you could do the same thing.
Maybe, and again, me spitballing, but maybe feathers are otherwise disadvantageous compared to hair, where hair is probably a lot simpler, a lot less resource heavy to make. So if mammals did produce feather, I guess there's two aspects to this. One of them is if a mammal did mutate where it would start growing feathers instead of hair, maybe the amount of resources it would take and energy it would take would be so draining that compared to animals that just grow hair or fur, those the furry animals versus the furry mammals versus the feathery mammals would proliferate because fur is a lot easier for their body to produce, to replace, but it still meets the same end. It's more efficient, ergo they win. But for birds, they adapted so that they can actually, using those feathers, fly, which you can't do with fur because I think the feathers are so much more rigidly structured and much more rigorous. Oh, dang it, I can't talk. They are so much more structurally rigid that they can support flight, whereas fur can't. So now all of a sudden the feathers are giving them an advantage, whereas for the mammal, before it learned to fly, they would only be a hindrance. And then they would die off before they learned how to fly.
Well, I feel like you could have, I mean, you wouldn't have to have massive feathers, like, say your arm hair is half an inch or something. I don't know. You could, if your feathers just grew to that length, it doesn't seem like they would take necessarily that much more energy to grow than hair would.
Right. Maybe. I mean,
But,
maybe they
I don't
still
know.
do. Or maybe there's another disadvantage to them. And the other aspect I was going to say is maybe feathers require several mutations where to get to that point is so statistically improbable. It's not that mammals can't produce them. It's not that maybe it's not even that they would be disadvantageous. Maybe they would actually be better than fur. But to actually get to that mutation is so improbable that maybe it just hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, maybe.
Because
In which
maybe there's several
case,
things that need to happen.
I am opening the challenge to all of our geneticists out there, or anybody with a CRISPR, is to stitch together some feather genes into a mammal.
I thought you mean feather like Levi's.
No, no. We want to see a dog with feathers.
Be kind of
Feathered
cool.
dog. know, they talk about feathering, like long hair, long
Yeah.
soft hair behind the ears or back of the legs, whatever. And then he can actually have feathers there.
Yeah. Nice.
All right. Anything else you want to add to that topic?
I don't think so. Again, the topic of the distinctions between humans and other mammals, I think we could still talk about, but we've explored it quite good so far. I think it's a good breaking time. How far are we? Oh, about an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah, we've extended beyond the norm. So, if you're still with us, thanks for sticking with us. And if you're not, then you won't hear this, so you won't know.
Yeah, think about it.
Actually, there's a channel I've followed on YouTube a little bit where, you know, a lot of them have like a sign off where they're like, thanks for watching. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe, sort of thing. And this guy has one that's like, if you didn't like what you heard, then thanks for sticking around so long. It's like, actually, that's really good because it's like, why would you listen all the way to the end of something if you didn't enjoy what you were hearing?
Maybe you were stuck. Like you're away from your computer working on something, or you can't control whatever
I suppose.
listening device is, so you are like literally stuck listening to it.
I suppose, yeah. But either way, I thought it was a clever sign off. And who knows, maybe he's converted some people because of that willingness to reach out to those who maybe don't like the content as much.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's wrap it for today, and we'll talk to you next time.
Sounds good. Thanks, y'all. Catch you
All
next
right.
time.